just maybe start where we left off, that would be great. Mm-hmm. This has actually been really helpful so far, so thank you. And I should also say that at least for this room, we have a hard stop at noon, so good news for you. we do have a few documents that I might want to run through with you, so nothing, and I apologize for not being able to sort of talk to you more about this in advance. We're a little bit on the fly here, so I think the February talking points memo that you drafted, there were a couple more that I just want to sort of ask about for, so I understand sort of what they mean, so as we sort of are ongoing doing our investigation. So, but I don't want that to stop this, because I think this is actually the most important thing in terms of getting your story, your recollections on how this all went down. So, so if we could just start back up with the meeting then, the reconvening a week later.
So walk them through kind of my view on why we should get out of this business, and part of it is just the underlying fundamentals of subprime mortgages, but also to the way these deals were structured. And one of the points that I was not so I could have done it in an easier way, but one of the points that I wanted to make is, for example, the mezzanine CDOs in particular were ones that were problematic, because the way it worked is a typical mezzanine ABS CDO involved, let's say, 50 triple B tranches of subprime RMBS. The margin for error on those triple B tranches are not very large. For example, if losses on the underlying pool of subprimes exceeded roughly 7%, that these triple B tranches would immediately start getting hit, and they'd be completely wiped out by the time it got to 8 or 9%. That's how thin these tranches are. So if cumulative losses on the underlying pools of subprime loans exceeded 7% and exceeded 10%, these triple B tranches would get wiped out. And so the problem with pooling 50 of these is that if we get it wrong in subprime mortgages as a general matter, whether it's in California, Florida, or whatever, if losses exceeded 10% because the underlying mortgages were priced to fail or were structured to fail, then there's a scenario where all 50 of those transactions will get wiped out. And just to put it into perspective, losses on subprime mortgage pools are like in excess of 40-50% in some cases.
Now,
if you look at it. So not only did you blow through the 7% layer, and by the way, those are on what happened after we got out of the business is that the subprime business continued to plow on and go even stronger, and underwriting standards just got progressively worse. So when you talk about vintages, 2006 and 2007 were by far the worst vintages of subprime mortgages, and 2004, 2005 on a relative basis were significantly better, albeit, even when I looked at it that back then, they were still pretty bad.
So what percent of the book was mezz CDOs versus high-grade CDOs,
Because, and if you think about this just conceptually, triple B tranches are these tiny little layers in this gigantic capital structure, and so mezzanine ABS CDOs were about a third the size of a high-grade deal, because high-grade deals were buying AAA tranches, which were very, which were 70% of the capital structure. So I think the ratio was basically 1 to 4. For every dollar of mezz, there was about $3 or $4 worth of high-grade.
Revenue or?
No, notional amount. So if you looked at the $60 billion that AIGFP had, there'd probably be something like $15 billion is mezz, and the rest, $45-ish billion at least were high grade, and And so, by the way, owning AAA tranches of the RMBS, in a lot of cases, a lot of those deals were never penetrated, those AAA tranches, because they had a high enough attachment point. But it's the mezz deals that could have gotten experienced a lot of problems. And so, part of when we're walking through the rationale of getting out, it's not only the underlying subprimes, but the way these deals are structured. The mezzanine, in particular, were very toxic because they're highly levered, thin slices where if things went badly, you can see how the entire tower of the mezz ABS CDO gets wiped out. And so I think, you know, that at the end of that meeting, I think we all came to the conclusion that we probably need to get out of this business.
And you had explained all of this in this meeting.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Starting from subprime, starting from kind of the rationale behind the business, you know, and the structure of these CDOs, why in aggregate this is just a bad business for us to be in.
So forced or agreed?
I think everybody, you see, it was very, I don't think everybody generally agreed that a lot of this stuff was factual and not an opinion. And so I think everybody kind of agreed that, hey, we probably need to get out of this business, but before we do so, let's go to a few big banks and talk to them. Hear their side of the story. Give us a reason. Tell us why this is a great time to go long subprime assets. And so,
can I jump in
for
a moment? The 4-to-1 ratio is notional. Do you have an idea what the revenue was?
Yeah, it's the same because basically the interesting thing is the pricing on those. On whether you did the super senior on a mezz or a high grade deal was identical. It was around 12, 13 basis points.
So 4-to-1 revenue as well.
Yes, okay. Exactly. So notional and revenue wise.
So whose idea was it to go to Wall Street firms and?
I think it was.
Get their feedback.
I think it was Allen's, interestingly enough. Because I think obviously he's quiet throughout this meeting and he's a little, he's definitely not joining everybody else and saying that.
This is his machine.
This is his machine, and he's like, why don't we talk to these guys? I can arrange meetings with the head of research of mortgage research and so forth. And so we arranged a meeting where myself, Alan, Gary Gorton, Andrew Forster, and Andrew Forster's kind of second in command, Tom Fewings, all, it was in New York. And one day we met with like three banks. And
which ones were they?
Goldman, Bear Stearns, and Credit Suisse.
Do you remember the names of the people that you met with at any of these places?
I don't. The only thing that I know is that Goldman, we met quickly with Dan Sparks, who was kind of running that business very quickly.
But was it substantive or meet and greet? How would you
just meet and greet? Just a meet and greet.
And during these meetings, did you set forth what you thought the problems might be?
No, we actually just, we would go to the typical meeting was, head of research who writes about subprime mortgages and ABS CDOs. Would kind of give us their walkthrough of this, the state of the business and the risks and so forth. And so all three of them kind of went through their thing. And not surprisingly, even though I think every one of them highlighted risks, they all felt like this was kind of this, very profitable machine and that, even though some of these mortgages, in some cases, were structured to fail, that all of the borrowers would basically get bailed out as long as real estate prices went up, and that if you took a look at 50 years, the last 50 years worth of real estate prices in the U.S. in aggregate, there wasn't one year where the residential real estate market went down, period. There were times where California went down a lot and other states, but in aggregate, It never went down, and that's the whole premise behind, you know, being able to, you know, refinance or, you know, loans and so forth. That as long as that machine was going, they would be able to.
Did anybody bring up that home prices hadn't increased as much on sort of a year-over-year basis in that 50-year period as they had in the years leading up to this? Most immediate years leading up.
I don't remember. I just remember just thinking, and my colleagues as well, were thinking that it seems like a very odd statement to say that just because it hasn't in the past, that prices go up in the past, that it will go up in the future.
Well, it's just something I've been struggling with, sort of independently of this, is if you have this historical data, it seems like the bubble, if you will, of home prices.
But remember, at that time, things were still, like at the end of 2005, real estate prices were still peaking. I mean, they were still hitting their peak. So it didn't really. There was this thing where it just went crazy, and that it was it. The picture looked really positive at that time.
But maybe you couldn't yet tell that these were aberrations.
No, I don't think so. I mean, no, I don't think you could. And I think, you know, not surprisingly, all three banks, as a general matter, you know. Felt like that this is one of the biggest it's a machine, and it's a machine that will churn without us.
So these are research people, just so I'm clear, are these the research, like internal research people who support the teams doing the deals, or
no,
are these sort of the supposedly independent,
so-called
on the other side of the wall?
Yeah, who write research pieces to their clients saying why they should go long ABS CDOs. So, you know, not surprisingly, they have, you know, they have a bias. Interestingly enough, you know, all of these meetings, everybody did raise the issues of no-doc loans, of, you know, the classic subprime mortgage was a two-year fixed-rate teaser at like 7% that gets flipped into a floating rate, in which case, you know, mortgage payments could go up at least 25-30%, in some cases even more. And you know, we kind of drilled down on that and saying, okay, so the next 2 years maybe these guys make it through, but what happens when they get flipped into a higher mortgage payment? And again, that whole idea of being able, as long as real estate prices go up, they're going to be able to refinance or sell that house at a profit, and so you've got nothing to worry about, because the mortgage that you have, actually, if it gets sold at a profit or refinanced, that mortgage pool actually pays down early at par. So it actually works in your favor if you're long the ABS CDO, because you get paid out early in advance to par. But it's all based on this underlying idea of house prices going up, which is kind of, you know, even with the group that we had, where everybody had slightly different views on things, I think everybody kind of agreed that is that's a tough thing to bet the farm on, you know.
Right. Yeah. So, quick question again about the book. Mm-hmm. On page 89, it sort of describes a little bit the meetings with the Wall Street firms. By the way, was Cassano at these meetings?
He was not. He knew that we were going to them because Andrew told him.
Okay.
But he was not.
So just the four of you?
It was just the one, two, five of us. So it's myself, Gary Gorton, Alan Frost, Tom Fewings, and Andrew Forrester.
So it says sort of in the middle, sort of full paragraph, if you go down, there's a parenthetical that says 2 months after their meeting with Goldman Sachs, one of the AIG FP traders bumped into the Goldman guy who had made this argument and who now said, between you and me, you're right. These things are going to blow up.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with this conversation? Was this you who had the conversation with the Goldman trader who said that?
Yeah, but it wasn't 2 months after. It was actually, it was at an ABS. It was at the ABS CDO conference, which I think was at the end of January, beginning of February. So it was actually before that I had a sidebar conversation with a fellow at Goldman who you know, we were at that meeting. That was actually the meeting in which I was introduced.
Okay, so yeah. I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
Wasn't the conference, you're talking about the conference in Las Vegas?
Yeah.
Wasn't that before you went to the various banks?
Yes, it was.
So this has it out of order. The book
this
has it out of order.
It's totally out of order.
Was the Goldman trader that you talked to at the conference the same as one of the Goldman people that were in these meetings?
I don't think so, no.
Okay. Do you remember the name of the Goldman trader who told you this?
Jonathan Eagle. Huh. Sound familiar?
Of late name.
So when you go to Goldman, then do you say, well, you know, Eagle told me it was going to blow up?
No, I mean, it was a kind of a sidebar conversation, and it was, you know, because basically at this conference, this was Alan's opportunity to introduce me to all of his contacts. You know, this was a huge conference. Everybody was there at the height of the market. So, you know, it was an opportunity within a day that I can meet all 15 banks that Alan talks to, and he can introduce me. But it was an odd conversation because at that point, you know, I already knew we were getting out of this business. He kind of knew that there's a good chance. So a lot of these guys are, you know, doing deals, a lot of deals, and their pipelines are getting bigger. So part of this initial meeting was to basically introduce myself, but also saying, we're reassessing this business, so give us a few weeks to figure it out, and just kind of explain it that way. And that's how I ran into Jonathan Eagle. He was in one of those meetings with Goldman.
Had he worked with Al Frost at all?
They knew each other well. I don't know what, you know, he's got people who work Fabulous Fab and guys like that who work for him who actually do most of the deals. So, no, everybody, you know, he was the most senior guy.
But presumably at this point, I'm just trying to get the chronology right. If the conference was in the late January, early February of 2006, Jonathan Eagle expresses this view to you. We know separately, or at least I believe separately.
And he didn't say it that strongly, by
okay.
the way. He didn't say it that strong. He just basically, you know, it was literally... we had a meeting. We're expressing. I basically said, you know, we're reassessing this because we don't like the fundamentals of the subprime market. And after the meeting, he's like, you know, I kind of see your point on this, you know, and you know, so it was definitely not that strong, but it was, you know, one of the few, the only investment bank that actually explicitly acknowledged that, you know, that this is something to keep an eye on.
So it sort of foreshadowed what we know now that Goldman did later that year.
Yeah, but he's just one guy out of the crew. It's hard to figure out.
Did you ever talk to him again? Did you ever meet?
No, that was the last time I talked to him, actually, I think.
Okay.
Just anything more from that conversation with Mr. Eagle?
No, not at all. No.
So by the time...
And I'm sorry.
No, keep going.
And the reason I ask is because, the book's inaccurate? The book's inaccurate, but there's to my mind anyway, there's a fairly big difference between I sort of see your point and you're right, it's going to blow up.
Right. So, right.
Is there anything in between, or is it just, you know...
Well, I think it's kind of important to make one statement, which is I can tell you that I was like the black sheep of the company at that time. I mean, by no means were people sitting there saying, "Oh my God, you're so." It was the exact opposite. It was basically, not only did the banks hate me, they literally despised me, but it was more of, you know, everybody thought we were insane to get out of this business because it was. Kind of just at the beginning of an incredible time. So people were kind of perplexed. People thought we were overreacting outside, and some people internally thought we were overreacting. And so it was by no means, I'll tell you, there's nothing obvious about, I can tell you I was always very bearish, but I would have never guessed that things would have gotten even remotely close to as bad as they did. And so you know, it's, I don't think anybody at that time, honestly, at least that I ran into, can really say, hey guys, this is a disaster waiting to happen. But the bigger point from our perspective is we weren't getting paid enough money to take that risk. That was a bigger issue from our perspective, is that I'm not going to opine on whether there's a train on its way. I just know that I'm just not getting paid enough to stand on these tracks, right? So so I think that that's the bigger point.
So in terms of the banks despising you, any particular or specific conversations you recall with any bankers?
Well, you know, I remember a fellow named Chris Ricciardi at Merrill Lynch who ran their ABS CDO business, and that they were one of the largest originators of ABS CDOs at the time, and he pulled me aside and said, you know, the day that you drop out, we're going to have 10 other people who are going to replace you. So don't think for a second that this is going to slow us down and all that sort of stuff. He was right, by the way. I mean, he was right. I didn't believe that. At the time, I believed we were by far the only guys doing this business. But you know, he felt pretty strongly about it. He thought we were making a big mistake. But obviously, I mean, it's a very important part of being able to keep the machine going, is that they needed a takeout of the super senior.
They jumped in.
That's a fascinating thing about what happened, which is, other than a bunch of monoline bond insurers who did a little, like MBIA and AmBank, who did little pieces of it, all of the banks, for the most part, just decided to keep it for themselves. And that's another example. And that's, if you took a look at what happened, AIGFP pretty much stopped doing the business at the end of 2005, beginning of 2006. All of 2006, 2007 vintages were sopped up by banks who originated these deals. They retained it because they all believed it was riskless. And that's why Merrill had to write down 70 billion, UBS 60-70 billion, Citigroup even more. I mean, every one of these guys, once AIG dropped out, found ways of selling some of it but retaining most of it, and they had to write it all down. But instead of being concentrated in one company, it was distributed amongst like 15 big banks, and so I think that cushioned the blow.
Did any of these banks call you or others at AIG and say, "How about 20 basis points?"
You know, it's interesting. No, they there's a discipline that they try to keep, which is keep pricing kind of where it is, and they might have tried to, you know, entice us with a little bit more, but I mean, like I said, it's, if you think about it from our perspective, it doesn't matter whether it's 15 basis points, 25 basis points, 100 basis points. You come to the risk that this is, you come to the conclusion that there's real risk. You don't get paid basis points. You get paid, you know, 10 tens of points up front for taking real risk. So.
But this is sort of after you've already told everybody that you're exiting the business. So I just wanted to.
It's a little bit more, again, just to go back to the kind of concept of it's in stages, and Gene, correct me if anything I'm saying is wrong here. Mm-hmm. But at that conference, kind of sensitized them to the fact that there was going to be a reassessment at the end of January.
Yeah.
And then there are the meetings with the three banks we've talked about.
Right.
But in terms of delivering an ultimate message, that comes still
after,
later.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, not much later.
Yeah.
Right. Right. I just have a couple of documents that I want to show you. Mm-hmm. And this is the first one. It's an email dated February 16th, 2006.
Yeah.
It's based AIG FCIC 00109440 through 442, I believe.
Can you read that one?
Yeah. It's
109440 mm-hmm. through 442. So take a minute and look it over. It looks like this is an analysis of the super senior subprime exposure. Oh, here you go.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay. Is this something you would have asked for?
This is something that, so Adam, one of the things that happened is, even though probably in as early as January we knew that we were exiting this business, is that Andrew in particular and Alan agreed that, you know, there were some verbal commitments to doing deals that a lot of these deals take several months to warehouse or to accumulate the underlying assets. And so we were almost pregnant with, you know, a handful of deals where, even though from a legal perspective we didn't have to close these deals, that they felt that it was appropriate that we honor and close the deals. And so there are a bunch of deals that, you know, even though they weren't closed and we could have gotten out, we decided to honor them and do that. And this looks like it might have been kind of a new deal, specifically a new deal that was being shown. And
well, if you look at the attachment, it actually has the names of, I believe, a whole bunch of CDOs.
Yep. So this is like a typical deal, right, where, you know, you've got, I don't know how many are in here, but like 50 or 60 deals that are dropped into an ABS CDO and then carved up.
So this isn't looking at the entire subprime exposure of the book.
This
is only looking at one deal.
This is one high-grade deal. And
would this have been a CDO squared?
No, this would be a typical ABS CDO. So, if, you know, again, if you took a look at this, there's probably like 50 or 60 RMBS transactions, or actually, let me take a look at this. There's a lot of CDOs in here as well.
Well, so if you look at the email too, I mean, the exposures, the MES exposure, $21 billion. MES exposure with reinvestment remaining, $16 billion.
That's looking at the very top of the
list. That's right. The first
exposure
email.
Super senior subprime exposure taken. Yeah, you're right. So this looks like, yeah, this looks like across the whole book. I think they just have a typo there that says 60 million.
I was wondering if that was a typo.
Yeah,
Thank you for pointing that out.
That must be a typo. It's 60 billion. That's what threw me off, is I looked at 60 million, but it looks like 60 billion. And
what would O/W stand for in the parentheses? So it says, for example, exposure to CDOs of ABS, 60 million or maybe billion, parenthetical, O/W, 31 billion subprime. Of which, maybe?
Of which, yeah.
Of which, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, yeah, you're right. So this looks like it's an aggregation of the entire book. The only thing that I think, you know, we need to point out is that there's also this terminology problem that I think we were running into at the time, which is there used to be either prime mortgages, and if it's not prime, it's subprime. Okay, but what the street did was it broke out the subprime into two other categories eventually, which is mid-prime and then subprime. So
So when this says of which so much percent,
subprime,
so much is subprime, what would subprime here have meant?
It's the one where it's one of three. So there's a mid-prime thing.
That this wouldn't have included.
Probably would not have included. And so that's why we were running, early on I remember we were running into terminology problems because, you know, if you truly categorize it as subprime, even though from our perspective you should group midprime in with subprime. And then, by the way, there's a new thing. There's another one inserted, which was alt A. So then it went.
Well, I was going to ask, would alt A go into a prime categorization?
It's between prime and midprime. So basically, think about it as it used to be prime, and anything that wasn't prime, it was subprime. But with this incredible growth, in order to create new categories of uncorrelated, you know, asset groups, new categories were created in subprime, where it actually went alt A, midprime, and then subprime. So, you know, the way I was trying to get the terminology straight was to say anything non-prime is subprime, but the way Adam and Alan would categorize it is subprime is truly the subprime, and forget about midprime and alt A are great, you know. And
so when you were having all these discussions about exiting the business,
yeah,
did that come into play?
Yeah, we came into basically saying let's just try to simplify categories and say that subprime, you know, subprime is anything that's non-prime, and so let's try to categorize that way. So what you'll see is that there are a lot of numbers that get thrown around where, you know, it depends on how you categorize that and what categories you use.
So when you decide to exit the subprime business, does that mean exiting subprime, midprime, and all
day? Yeah, all of them.
So that's where I was.
Yeah.
No. That's. I appreciate that. So I just. This is. I believe this is the email that you mentioned earlier, where you had to write a formal.
Yeah.
Memo to or email to, yeah, Joe Cassano, mm-hmm, and just for the record, this, yeah, is AIGFCIC00109490. It's an email dated February 28th, 2006. From you to Joe Cassano, CCing a bunch of people.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I'm sure you remember it. You,
yeah,
can take a minute and read it.
Yep.
So, when did you start drafting this?
Probably a week or so beforehand, that's my guess.
And was everyone on that CC'd on it included in drafting process?
Other than Joe, yeah.
Other than Joe. Okay, so Andrew Forster, Alan Frost, Gary Gorton. Who is Sheridan Teasel, by the way?
He's another guy in London who is like the third guy below Tom Feelings.
Okay.
So
was he like an analyst or?
He was kind of like a trader. So think of Andrew as the head trader, Tom Feelings as the next level, and Sheridan kind of slightly below him, but in London.
So did you get a, so this, basically the email, it says, below summarizes the message we plan on,
yeah,
delivering to dealers later this week with regard to our approach to the CDO of ABS Super Senior Business going, yeah, forward.
Can I give you a little context behind,
please,
this? So basically, this, you know, because our relationship with the banks were so significant, Joe and Alan, in his new role, were very concerned about how we deliver this message and wanted to find a elegant way to get out of this business. And so Joe wanted us to write something where he approved it to make sure that it doesn't come across too harsh. And so even though our intentions were to get out of all of the businesses that involve subprime, we basically came up with a certain category of the business that we were doing and tweaking it in such a way that we knew that there's no way they can written. So basically just do high-grade deals only, where, you know, very specific requirements on high-grade deals. Can't do the we're not doing the mezzanine deals. And we did it in such a way where we knew it was just impossible to originate it. And that kind of gave us a, you know, it's hard to go 100 miles an hour and then come to a complete stop. That was our way of saying, we're not coming to a complete stop. If you can somehow change your business mix to include something that's a little less risky from our perspective, we'll be happy to entertain that. But the reality is given those new constraints, you know, there's no way, you know, a deal would have been originated that can meet those constraints. So this was trying to figure out a way to try to pull it back without sounding like, hey guys, we woke up today and found out we made a grave mistake and we want to get out. And the other thing behind the context is that Andrew was very, if you think about it from both Andrew and Alan's perspective, this is deeply embarrassing, right? And behind all this, even though they kind of agree that this is a good time to exit, it's deeply embarrassing that they've got $60 billion of this. And so part of this is also a way to elegantly tell Joe, hey, Joe, we're really being really smart about this and that the stuff that we've done so far is perfectly fine, but we see a problem coming up and we want to get out in advance. And so that was the message. That's not the message I would have given, but that's the message. And everything's very scripted with Joe, for Joe, for obvious reasons.
Did you believe that everything before 2005
was fine? No, definitely not. But did I think it was, you know, going to spectacularly collapse the way it did? No, definitely not. But if I wrote this thing, it wouldn't have sounded right. Like this. It would have been, you know, something more extreme, like we should get out of this stuff.
Well, you did write it though.
Yes. Yeah.
But it was just with input from. Other members of the team.
Yeah.
So you sent this email to Joe. Did you ever hear back from him?
Nope.
Did you ever get a message from anyone else that he had approved it?
Yeah. Andrew told me verbally, I believe.
Did he make any comments or changes to the message?
No. The only thing that I remember, and I don't remember if it was right after this or some time beforehand. The one thing that I remember Andrew telling me is that Joe was surprisingly receptive and thought it was very mature of all of us to drop a business that's going gangbusters because we see a problem coming up. And that's, you know, he appreciated that and so forth. So unlike the message that's in this book, you know, it happened quickly. And we never turned, we never looked back. Once we shut this business down, I moved on to a different business. Alan worked on different things. We never looked back, and that was the end of it. And as far as we were concerned, you know, hopefully we dodged a bullet.
So who was then responsible for delivering this message to the dealers?
I was, along with, you know, pretty much I was. I'd call up or Alan would call up and I would get on the line and I would kind of give this message to all of them. But remember, by this time, this is weeks after the conference where we gave everybody a heads up that we're putting things on hold. Not surprisingly, everybody kind of knows what that means as soon as those, you know, and so I don't think anybody was particularly surprised when we said this and that. It didn't matter what our excuse was, they knew we were out.
About how many dealers or counterparties did you have to contact with this message?
My guess is like 12.
Would these be similar to the counterparties that...
It's every major counterparty. The only one that we didn't do business with was Citigroup, because they retained all of their deals from the very beginning. They didn't need a super senior provider.
So for example, when you called up Goldman, mm-hmm. was it Dan Sparks that you talked to?
No, it was
Andrew Dabbleman?
It was Andrew Dabbleman, yeah.
And what was his response?
I think I don't remember. I don't remember what his response was, but I think everybody kind of knew it was coming. It wasn't like it was a surprise, and I think the general feedback was, we think you're going to change your mind when you see how much more business we're going to be doing.
When you went to Goldman that day for the meeting, mm-hmm. kind of in between the conference and this, was Andrew Doppelman there?
Yes, he was the guy who was. Yes, he's really our main point of contact on the sales side, and he shepherds us to different groups. But yeah, he's the one, and he's the guy who we talked to directly, or Alan talked to directly, and then I eventually did.
But you don't remember who the research person was at Goldman?
No idea.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
The message delivered in writing to anybody? Or just all phone calls?
All phone calls, yeah. Yeah, and so, like I said, the message was delivered, and there was no looking back, and that was the end of the story, and wasn't until years later that it reared its ugly head.
So I want to keep going. So go ahead and.
And you maybe already covered this, but end of the story. But you still have commitments, essentially forward commitments.
Well, so that's where I'm going. Yeah. Okay. So I think that I would, if it's possible to help this jog your memory.
Yeah.
This is a list. That's been given to us from AIG, the multi-sector CDS portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you turn to the third page, which is AIG FCIC 00336719,
mm-hmm.
We can draw a line. It's 6 deals down. The last deal in 2005 is called Sherwood 2005-1.
Mm-hmm.
And then, if you look, there's a column over to the right over here that says subprime collateral, yes or no.
Yep.
And then if you go down several deals later to the May 19th, 2006, Hout Bay 2006-1 deal.
Yep.
That appears to be the last one, where in the column to the right it actually indicates that it included subprime collateral.
Yep.
So there are about 12 to 15 deals here.
Yep.
So I just was wondering, would all of these deals have been in the pipeline before January of 06?
Vast majority, meaning maybe one or two. And I don't know, I don't remember those last two deals, Hout Bay or Bernoulli.
Okay.
But there's a good chance that those deals might have had some subprime, but it was a very small sliver in some way. Or either that, or they were entirely high grade deals with certain characteristics, but there was a substantial amount. Remember, a lot of these transactions took anywhere from 3 to 5 months to warehouse, and so you could see how a lot of these things took a while to finalize. So I'd say a vast majority of these were committed to by the beginning of January in one form or another, verbally, not legally.
So most of these would have been done by Al Frost.
Yep.
But would there have been a few of them that you would have?
No, I'm positive I didn't execute one transaction on my own. But then again, remember, at this stage, Adam Budnick is actually the guy who's executing the transactions, and Alan was overseeing. But basically starting in February is when I started looking at deals in the pipeline and so forth. But everything up to that point, Alan still was still controlling things.
If you don't mind, just want to have a minute to. I'll talk with you about something.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Step out, or
why don't you guys just step in the hallway? Yeah. That's fine. Yeah.
Thank you.
we just want to be a little maybe more detailed or clearer kind of about where he is in the process at this point.
Yeah. I think, yes.
Yeah, so remember, somewhere at the beginning of 2006 when I kind of started taking this business over, and I don't remember when it officially happened, or maybe it happened over a period of time, there's a point where I start getting CC'd on a bunch of emails. Like, now, eventually, Adam Budnick, who's executing these deals, is not only CC'ing Alan, but he's also CC'ing me, saying these are the status of the deals and so forth. And so when I say, you know, I didn't execute them, first of all, I didn't execute them because they're, you know, Adam would be the guy who executes these deals. But I'm certain that there will be a whole series of emails at some stage in time where anything that Adam's working on, closing deals, he's going to send messages to me, Andrew Forrester, Alan Frost, whoever he feels necessary along the way. So, you know, so that's definitely going on. And you know, that's, yeah, and so to say that, like, you know, not involved at all is wrong. I mean, I think, you know, definitely part of the chain at that stage.
So if you could help me understand how the process works, would it have been the case that legally AIGFP was already on the hook, or that you just felt, or that FP, when I say mm-hmm. you, I mean
yeah.
FP, felt that they'd agreed in principle to these, so it would be sort of the wrong thing to do to stop deals already in?
Yeah, I think it was more of the latter. I mean, I think that's the feeling. I mean, I remember us discussing this, and it was more of the latter, which is, hey, you know, we said we were going to do these deals, and even though we haven't signed a contract, because you don't sign anything until the deal closes and gets funded. So it literally is on this actual start date is the actual day where we legally sign and are committed to it. But up until that point, we've said that we're indicated that we're going to move forward on a transaction.
And was this discussion that you're referring to in that video conference when you're back, you do research, and then all of you have, and you're talking about what you're likely to do and what you're likely not to do?
Yeah, I think so. I can't remember what part of it was, you know, on a video conference or phone calls, but basically the deal was that, you know, for deals that we feel morally obligated to close, we should close, but we should not be executing any new deals unless they meet very stringent guidelines, and let this thing just kind of roll off.
So is it fair to say there was concern about going forward, but the concern was not so acute as to stop sort of the 12 or so deals that, I mean, because it's a significant amount of deals, is
yes.
the reason I pointed
yep.
out. I
yep.
mean, when we hear about AIG exited this business at the end of 2005, I mean,
yep.
this is probably less about your personal involvement to some extent, but there's a significant number of deals
yep.
that actually come after that. So just trying to figure
right.
out.
Remember also the thought process was that if we believe that these deals were going to be seriously problematic, we probably would have gotten out of them at the time. So that gives you a little more insight about the thought process at the time, which is, you know, this is not an emergency situation that we just want to kind of elegantly drop out of this business, and that, you know, doing these extra few deals is not, but it is a lot. I do remember at some stage Adam sending, you know, an update on the deals in the pipeline, and we're all like, are you kidding me? I mean, there's a lot of deals. And, you know, and so...
Although I guess it's worth pointing out, and this is so I remember this later, if the email that we were just looking at that you sent to Joe Cassano with talking points was on February 28th.
Yeah.
And if we look at this chart, after February 28th, it looks like there were 7 deals that included
right.
subprime.
Right.
So.
And, I mean, and... maybe I'm just repeating something that everybody heard you say, but in terms of the video conference and the sentiment expressed about the likelihood that these deals would fail,
mm-hmm.
what were people saying?
I think, again, I think people, everybody's got a different view, but I think as a general matter, people believed that that they didn't think that we were going to sustain a loss on any transaction we did, and that if anything, it'd be more of a mark-to-market issue, so a valuation issue on the swaps, if anything.
Actually, was the mark-to-market issue discussed at that point?
You know, not, well, no, but the point was is that, you know, what and I remember it was this was Andrew saying this, is that his belief was that we would never have to actually make a payout. This was back in end of 2005, beginning of 2000, that we wouldn't have to make a payout on anything, but the, you know, the mark-to-market in the future potentially can get to a point where it'd be significant. I remember him saying that, and that was kind of the end of that conversation. But, you know, there's very little talk about mark-to-markets. And
was there any discussion at that point of the provisions of the contracts that required AIG to post collateral?
Yeah. So that's a very good point, because honestly, that to me, that's what drives the big issue at AIG FP.
Well, it's really interesting. I noted at the very beginning, you said that your new business, you don't post collateral.
Yeah, and that's always been rule number one at AIG FP since I joined, which was the credit business was the only unhedged business the company ran, and that because of the custom-tailored nature of the transactions we do, where there's only one other, we're the only people doing a very specific basket of transactions, that there's no market for things. And AIG FP, AIG is an insurance company, it's not a bank. So you've got an asset liability thing. So ingrained into the way the company, the credit business was set up, the transactions, all super senior transactions when I joined, either had an explicit carve out saying that no collateral whatsoever, and that the in that literally you take the senior unsecured risk of us, and in a very limited circumstance there was collateral posting, but it had nothing to do with mark to market. It basically said if I attach at 15% and we get to 13% of losses, that we would post a 2% buffer at all times.
So these are based on actual
realized losses, and that not mark to markets, not or anything, nothing like that. And that's the credit derivative business that I executed, and that's kind of the way the place was set up. And it wasn't until long after I left, and I listened to a conference call right during the crisis with Joe Cassano on a quarterly conference call where he mentioned collateral posting, and I just I remember that vividly. It was like, you know, maybe a couple of years afterwards, I called up someone at AIGFP. I was like, there's collateral posting on these deals, and they're like, yeah, there is.
So you weren't aware of that?
I don't think anybody. I don't know, but no.
So when Forrester talked about the mark-to-market stuff in passing, sounds like it wasn't a big part of the conversation in late 05, early 06. It was not with respect to these collateral requirements in the contract.
Absolutely.
So if we were to pull the corporate CDS contracts and compare them to the multi-sector CDS contracts, they'd be different.
Yeah, I think that's
on the collateral provision.
Absolutely. Somewhere along the way, and I don't know at what stage Alan did this, he agreed to post collateral. But based on a ratings mechanism where, you know, if the company gets downgraded below whatever single A, then they post collateral. And the issue, you know, that's the big issue, right? Because, you know, it's arguable that a vast majority of the super senior transactions off the ABS CDOs that AIG did will not experience any losses. I don't know how much of it has, but I can tell you it's probably going to be a fraction of the notional, still measured in billions, but not tens of billions. And so that you know, somewhere along the way, an agreement was made to post collateral, and that's a much different game, right? That's a completely different game. It's one thing, like the company that I belong to, where we have $500 million of cash, and that's as much as the company can give away. And in this case, it was, the numbers could get very large. And what made it even worse, from what I understand, is that it's typical that if you do a transaction with a dealer, the dealer actually is a calculation agent to determining what the proper mark is. So they, ISDA has this mechanism which basically says that who's the calculation agent if you are posting mark-to-market collateral. In almost all cases, the dealer will require them to be that agent, since they...
So your counterparty is the one who gets to decide.
So if it's Goldman, Goldman says that, I think the mark is, off of this billion-dollar transaction, you owe me $500 million, and they win, right, because of the way the documents... And so that the combination of that, the fact that there is a collateral posting, and that Goldman or any dealer was the calculation agent, is the perfect storm.
So in your experience, these provisions would have been an anomaly in the market and even within AIGFP?
Well, it's an anomaly with AIG because of the way we were set up, that, posting collateral against these things was against the grain of the way this business was set up. And so, and that's clearly the issue. And the reality is that there is no real market for these things. And if you put yourself in the position, even if things, just swung wildly, that you can just get collateral called. And that's exactly what happened. It was a liquidity squeeze for AIG and P.
So based on your experience sort of being the counterpart to Alan Frost on the corporate credit mm-hmm. book, who would have been, if Alan is negotiating these and Adam Butnick is helping him negotiate these, would anybody above Alan have needed to sign off on the contract? I understand that they had the credit risk report for the committee at AIG Corporate who would have signed off on it, but would anybody have signed off on the contractual provisions?
Well, first of all, I don't think collateral provisions were even in that report, because it didn't start off that way, and probably if you pulled one of those things, I'm fairly certain you're not going to see anything about collateral posting at all. But the process, and again, this was more of an info, there isn't like an employee handbook, but the process was, it would naturally have to be, you'd have to go to Andrew Forrester, but those are the decisions that Joe Cassano usually signs off on. So at least, if I was in that business, the natural people to, when you negotiate anything involving collateral, it would naturally be, your immediate boss plus Joe, or make sure that your immediate boss tells Joe about it.
Would it be possible for Alan Frost just to tell in-house counsel, put it in there, and not make a specific point about sharing it with Forrester or Cassano?
Yeah, it's very, it's probable in my case. I'm guessing.
I mean, no.
Yeah, I don't know.
Is it possible?
Yeah, it's possible.
Of course, well.
I'm just trying to figure out where we would go to figure out the answer to this question.
Well, there's plenty of people we can go to. but you mentioned that you heard about collateral postings during a quarterly conference call.
Yeah.
Was that the December 5th, 2007 conference
call? Yeah, I think that's right.
And I think you said that after you heard that, you called up, I guess, former colleagues at AIG and asked, who did you call?
I don't remember. I mean, the natural person would be Adam Budnick and or Gary Gordon.
And when you talked to them, generally what was the discussion, but specifically what we're interested in was, were they saying, we didn't know those provisions were in the contract?
I think pretty much everybody that I talked to, and again, that's probably Adam and Gary, And, you know, there's also, you know, Bob Powell was the lawyer that did work with, you know, the lawyer would know about it as well, obviously. So Jake's son, I don't think I've ever talked to Jake's son about this, who was the lawyer in charge. But I've talked to Bob Powell about this and asked him his opinion, and he, you know, he said it was a surprise to them as well. So I honestly, you know, who knows?
So you spoke to Jake Powell and he said it was a surprise to him, or you've heard that Jake Powell said that it
was a surprise? It's Bob Powell.
Bob Powell.
Yeah. So Bob Powell, I believe I talked to him subsequent.
I don't know if there's any
relevant.
That's not my
privilege.
Point. Yeah, I just don't want us.
In the company, though.
Yeah. So, I know, but you know,
well, fine.
It's not
let me try to do it this way. Was Mr. Powell someone that was supposed to review the contracts before the deals signed?
Not the ones that Alan.
So we talked about, you may have been out. So Powell did it for the corporate credit book.
The guy.
The son was it for the ABS
book.
Yeah.
Okay. And did you speak, without telling me what you said, did you speak to Mr. Son? Like you spoke to Mr. Powell?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I didn't.
Okay. And did you, other than Gordon and Budnick, did you speak to anybody else at AIG after you heard about the collateral calls?
I'm sure I have. I kind of talked to a lot of different people there on and off. And, you know, I was as surprised as pretty much everybody else that I've talked to there that there was a collateral provision on those deals.
So, who do you know at AIG that knew those provisions were in the contract?
I think the only two people who would know that for certain is Alan Frost, Adam Budnick, and Jake's son, who's a lawyer. Those are the three people you know had to have been involved in that.
Well, I thought you said a minute ago that you didn't think Adam, that you talked to Adam, and I don't remember what
words. Oh, yeah, that's true. And he basically said it was a surprise to him. You know, here's the strange thing about it is that when you create this machine and things are cookie cutter, sometimes these sort of details kind of escape you. And so that might have been, you're right. I mean, I believe I had talked to Adam, and maybe he did know about it. I don't remember.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for that. I think that I'm about done for now. I'm sort of curious to. Okay, we have 10 more minutes, FYI.
Okay.
So you
well,
go
there,
ahead.
There's certainly one area we want to cover, and that is again, our good friend Mr. Lewis covers this sort of the last point he covers,
yep.
Sort of about AIG and this, and that is after the decision is made to get out, there's no decision to hedge.
Right.
Do you call any discussions about whether or not to hedge the super senior CDS exposure?
Yeah, we you know, I had brought it up once or twice with Andrew and his group, and you know, there was a deal where we actually were trying to hedge out our MES ABS exposures. Aggregate them and get another bank to, because remember, like for example, UBS was telling us that, you know, they like this business so much that they're doing it themselves, and so we said, oh fine, you want to do, hey, how about some of ours? And so we put a transaction together, and I remember them coming back, and we put it on at a weighted average cost of 15 basis points, and they came back at like 20 basis points, so five wider. So we would actually have to pay out 5 basis points per annum to cover this position. And off of billions of dollars, that's real money. And so I passed that by Andrew, and Andrew said, you know, we're not going to pay a dime for this. If we can get out at cost or better, we'll do it. But otherwise, Otherwise, we'll stick with it. And there was also thoughts of hedging using the index, the ABX index, or buying protection through ABS CDS, which we did get approval to do about $1 billion of. And the London folks actually bought like 150-ish million of protection. Joe stopped that because after we put on the first 150, Joe didn't like the market moved against us, so things got even better, tighter, and we were losing money on that 150 million, and we were paying for this protection, so cash is going out the door in premiums that Joe said, you know, I don't think the world's going to blow up. I don't want to spend that money. Stop it. So even though we were originally going to put on close to $1 billion of protection on top of this, it stopped at about $150 million.
So the $150 million hedge, is that short in the ABX or doing an ABS CDS?
I think it was a combination of the two.
Okay. And you remember the timing?
It was probably in late February, early March. Right after we closed down this building,
'06,
yeah.
Okay, and the UBS deal, same time frame.
Exactly, same
or the
time. Yeah.
Almost UBS
yeah.
deal.
Right.
And then was that the end of it, at least for your tenure?
Yeah, that was it.
No more even discussions about trying to hedge the portfolio as you go throughout '06 and into the first couple of months of '07.
It's just the opposite, right? I mean, literally, that you know, at the end of '06, it was very clear that this business is even bigger than we even imagined it to be, and that the street didn't even skip a beat with us disappearing from the market, which we were I was a little surprised about. But no, and so if anything, it was more of like maybe we kind of screwed up. But I don't think anybody, you know, it wasn't that big of a business for us, for anybody, that people didn't spend time second guessing, you know, our decision to get out, and that it was pretty much over and we moved on, and that, you know, it wasn't until well after I left that it cropped up again.
I'm sorry I missed this. What was this, like, the notional size of the proposed deal with UBS? How much risk would that have taken off?
I think we wanted to do a few billion dollars just to test the market to see whether we can get something done, and if that worked, we'd roll it out in a bigger way. But I think it was a few billion.
You mentioned Jake DeSantis mm-hmm. was someone who asked you to talk to Michael Lewis.
Yeah.
What was his role at AIGFP?
He's totally outside of this. He was an equity derivatives trader, and then he became a head of commodity derivatives trading. So virtually no overlap at all on the business.
Okay. So he wouldn't necessarily be someone that would have any institutional knowledge
of what
went on. Who else? The people that I've heard so far, Al Frost, Gary Corton, Andrew Forster, Tom Fewings, Adam Budnick, are there other people that we should talk to that would have knowledge about these events in the
other
book
than,
of business?
You know, from a legal perspective, Jake's son was the lawyer there. But it really is confined to that group of people, and interestingly enough, if you kind of deviated outside of that, other people knew very little about, you know, the business that was going on in there.
I just noticed in your February 28th email, that doesn't appear to be going to any of the big dogs in Connecticut. It's not going to Martin Sullivan.
In New York.
New York, yeah.
Does that mean something like this? Doesn't have to be run by?
Not really. I mean, they're in risk management, so the fewer deals we do, the better, as a general matter. So no, I don't think we even ran this. The only time we ran this by them, I believe, is when we wanted to buy protection, $1 billion of protection on the index. I believe we had to go downtown for approval for that, which they gave us. But other than that, there's no clearance. I mean, you know, necessary. Joe is really the guy who makes those decisions.
You've talked a little about Bob Lewis,
yeah.
The risk officer in New York, I think. We've heard about a guy named Makatis, I think his name.
Pierre Makatis.
Yeah. Yeah. Risk officer, yeah. Within FP,
yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Was he in London, Connecticut?
He was in London.
Was he involved?
Not at all. Not at all. You know, the credit business was carved out of his world. Why? I mean, it's more historical.
In terms of your, did you deal with?
Never.
Yeah.
Not at all. The business didn't involve, credit derivative business really didn't involve Pierre at all the time.
Did it involve risk management at all?
The risk management function was entirely Andrew Forrester's. It was his book of business.
I just want to make sure it's clear what's Gene's impression, rather, you know, given where he sat and what he did. You know, we don't want to run into the dangers of opining too broadly, so keep in mind where he's coming from.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's
you're
a
welcome
good point.
To go through that here, and if you don't want to walk
no,
out.
No, I just don't. I mean, okay.
If there's a lot of things.
I want Gene to be the one. You want to hear from Gene, not
yes.
from me.
Yeah.
So I want it to be in his own words.
Yeah, and the reality is, you know, if you think about it, a lot of these things, I'm trying to give you my view of the world, not from a lawyer's perspective, and literally. My understanding, like the Pierre Makatis thing, is one of those things. I just know that he wasn't really involved in it. Could he have been involved in it? Yeah, he could have, but it's.
So let's stick to the specifics
obvious.
Of
yeah.
what you ought to know,
yeah.
right? So on the corporate credit side,
yeah.
what risk management function, if at all, did you deal with?
It would be Andrew Forrester, whose book of business it would go. He would have analysts who kind of take a look at the names. He had credit analysts. We also had a credit group in Wilton who took a look at all the underlying corporate obligations and the IBMs and approved and disapproved. And once it and that is it. So on the trading side and on the credit side, and then finally, there's a credit memo that goes to the parent.
Okay.
Okay.
I think that's about it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate it.